This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world.
Today on Dreamland, we're going to be talking to William Sosa. Bill has done a lot of work on the Dendera lights. He has built some things that are quite remarkable, actually, and following on the work of others in this same area, work that is roundly denounced by the skeptical community. And let's get past that at the beginning. I'll introduce Bill in a moment. Bill has been working on these lights for a long time. Bill, welcome to Dreamland.
Oh, pleasure. Hi, pleasure to meet you.
Well, good. I'm glad you came. I happened to see a video of Bill on YouTube, and I thought, my goodness, this is the best worked out version of this I've ever seen. And Bill, can you tell us a little bit about your background in engineering and so forth?
Sure. You know, I've always been technical ever since I was a kid. And I used to tear open televisions and radios that I found in the trash. I went to a technical high school. I went to a technical. I went to college for electromechanical technology, but I dropped out and went into the Air Force, and that's where I really picked up my skills, because the Air Force had something that I found interesting, which was hands on. They didn't do a lot of hands on in college. It was a lot of theory. And to me, if you can learn the thing first and then find the theory, it was easier than going to the theory first to try and find the device. And I would use that kind of thinking probably for the rest of my career. If I could see it work first, then I could theorize how it worked. And I just have interest in UFOs and things like that. I've had some interest in that for forever since, Chariots of the Gods days. And I was following a lot of that kind of stuff. And then later I got into free energy, the ideas of free energy and, the stuff, the information that's out there about that. So I've always been able to apply my skills to physical things. And that's really been my ace. And
Well, good. All right. Let me set the scene a little bit, folks. For those of you, the few of you who don't know what the Temple of Dendera is, this is a temple attributed to Hathor. It was discovered by Europeans. Obviously, it was known to Egyptians for quite a while before this, in 1799, during Napoleon Bonaparte's survey, basically, of Egypt, by a man called Dominique Denon, who sketched the Dendera zodiac, which was on the ceiling of the small chapel atop the temple, whereupon they proceeded to take it to France, which is typical of what was done in those days, and not quite what we would do today. In any case, this temple has a cellar in it, a deep basement. You've been in it, I presume.
Yeah, I first visited Dendera in 97, and I've been there in 99, and I went there in 2012. So yeah, I'm quite familiar with the Dendera. I wasn't when I first went, but I definitely am today.
What's it like going down there? Because you go down a long stairway into the cellar.
Exactly.
What's it like?
My first time there, I really went kind of cold. I was with a tour group, but I didn't know the temple very well. And some of the information I had turned out to not be helpful. So as soon as I got there, the tour guide said to me, Bill, you're going to need to get into the crypt first, because there's going to be a lot of people who want to get in there. It's very small. The group's going to the roof to do some work. Why don't you take off and find it? So I did it. And I finally was just lost. And so I drew a picture, and this guy, the guide said, oh, and he took me over to a hole in the ground that had dirt still in it. They hadn't even dug the passageway out. But basically, you go down into a path, a tight passageway, and then there's a small staircase that leads to a long, narrow passageway or crypt. And what I did that day is I just threw my bags, my hat in, and my claustrophobia away, and dived in head first.
Yeah, claustrophobia would have been an issue for me for sure. It's a they did have a tendency to do things deep underground in Egypt, and I've often wondered if we've discovered all of it or even m much of it. I suspect not. I suspect there's a lot that's still there, and I sometimes think to myself that I'm sorry, folks, if my audio has been faint. I'm need to hold the microphone a little closer. In any case, that there may be some suppression of information that doesn't fit the conventional paradigm. And this is the conventional paradigm. I pulled this off of one of the websites that discusses the lights and the work you and others have done on them. I'll quote, and people are under the false impression that the images are depicting ancient light bulbs and conclude the ancient Egyptians made use of light bulbs. These false ideas are repeated and parroted quite often over the internet and sensationalized on TV shows such as Ancient Aliens, which seems to be the great bugaboo of the conventional archaeological community. It's quite puzzling that so many people accept these ideas coming from people who don't show a proficiency in the language of the ancient Egyptians, in order to convey what the Egyptians said of the images themselves. Out of all the far-fetched ideas floating around today related to ancient Egyptian cultural phenomena, the people who promote such ideas never give a translation of the inscriptions that accompany such images. Well, I actually did work on that, and I do have some translations that I'm not proficient enough in hieroglyphics to really translate, especially these very sophisticated hieroglyphics. But I will say this: I have read Susan Brin Morrow's book of The Dawning Moon of the Mind very carefully, and I would like to submit her thesis applies here. The people who translate the translate hieroglyphics are generally very much Eurocentric in their cultural bias, and they work from the assumption that the Egyptians were primitive, simple people, and therefore what the hieroglyphics say must reflect primitive and simple ideas. This is false. So, on that basis, let's move on a little bit. Now you were originally you're in there, you're looking at these things, they're right in front of you. What crosses your mind? Because you've gone a long way since then with this. We're
Right.
going to see the actual lights working, folks. So go ahead.
Like for me, I definitely had seen it once before, but didn't give it much thought in like the early 70s, 80s. I don't know exact, but I came aware of it definitely around 1993, 94, when the internet came out. And I started finding pictures online from the, Peter Cross's book, Lights of the Pharaoh. And other things, but it was very disjointed in the early days of the internet. You got grainy photos back, and like I said, I didn't even know where anything was when I went there because I didn't have good reconnaissance information of the temple. I could find it today easily, but when I looked at it, first of all, I remember back in the 70s there was a program that talked about the lack of soot in the paint of the I'm sorry, the paint of the
Well, that's
crypts,
okay.
and that was interesting to me because it's like, okay, they had this mirror idea that they were going to shift mirrors around and bring the light down into the tombs, but when I started looking at the Dendera light, I was like, this is not a light bulb, okay? It's very impractical. It's very large. You got people sitting underneath it. I mean, it's not a lamp, so I was very skeptical of that. And then, of course, over the time, people kept calling it the Dendera light, the Dendera light, and they brought up the soot thing. But it's like, no, look at the, I didn't look at the hieroglyphics. I'll be clear. I didn't get a hold of the hieroglyphics until way after I got the thing working. You know, the text on the walls. There's a really good book out there written by a Frenchman named Sylvie Caldy. He took the entire, I think it's he took the entire temple and translated practically everything. But it's in French, and so it doesn't help me that much. But I've had some of the French translated, you know, and that's what I've used since then to kind of understand it. But when I started originally, you know, posting my results online, I got hit a lot with people that were talking about the light bulb. It's not a light bulb. It's not a light bulb. And this one guy, Frank Dornberg, he wrote me back, and he's like, "No electricity, no electricity." And he started sending me some passages that he had translated. And it's like, no, you don't understand. These are technical information. There was something about the lotus flower gives forth the sun of a new day, and the jet pillar lifts the envelope that creates the sun in the sky eternal. And he's like, no light bulb. And I'm like, no, it's describing the sun. It's describing, you know, cosmology. It's describing how suns work. And I never got very much past him with that. But that was that to me, that's constantly been the problem. Of separating the light bulb theory that people hear and have been, you know, indoctrinated with what it really is, which is it's a model of the solar system. It's a model of how stars are made. And that's what the walls tell us. So when I first got, you know, I first got into it, I made the we got the light bulb. I was working with a friend of mine from the Air Force, my friend Ken, and we started around 2010 to really focus on it. And when we first got the, you know, the light bulb working in 2012, I started to you know, well, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Okay, you started, you got the light bulb working in 2012, and then you lost your train of thought.
Yeah,
Yeah,
what
okay, you
was the
got the
question?
light bulb working, but let's go back a little bit.
I remember now. So,
Okay.
I had the light working, and I, then we got a hold of the hieroglyphics, and it started talking about the day and the night bulb, how the lotus flowers again giving out the sun of a new day, and so that caused me to really start looking at it as cosmology, as physics, and that's really been my focus for the last few years, the last, you know, eight or so years, and it's just been amazing how much the device matches the information we see from the from space. Particularly right now, we've got the James Webb telescope out there, totally demolishing the Big Bang theory on a daily basis because it's bringing back information that they didn't expect from their cosmology. But it all fits with this Egyptian cosmology. So it reads like mythology, but it's actually explaining real physics. I mean, the lotus flower physics. The idea that the sun comes out of a womb. Well, it one of the biggest mistakes that was made in our physics is this belief that gravity creates suns, and this idea that, you know, gravity is the limiting factor of the size of suns and things like that. And that came to us through Newton 400 years ago, and that then later fusion was discovered. You know, fission and fusion, atomic research. And so they just assumed there's a fusion generator or fusion reactor inside the sun. And this is where we were led from the things we were told from Newton about gravity and things like that. But if you apply plasma physics, particularly this fluid dynamic plasma physics that this device embodies, you have another, I'm sorry again, you have another model that you can put against the information you have out there, and it fits much better. We're trying to find the fusion center of the sun. It doesn't exist. The sun is not even the source of all the energy. The energy, if you look at a light bulb, it's getting its energy from a socket somewhere. The light bulb is not producing energy, but if you were to look at it and you feel the heat and you say, wow, this thing's producing heat. No, it's not. It's getting its energy from the socket. The same way the sun gets its energy from the spiral arm that goes back to the center of the Milky Way galaxy. So the spiral arm is like a wire, is like a conduit that is bringing electrical energy, AC, alternating current, into the solar heliosphere. And when it comes to the solar heliosphere, it reaches the sun. This is what I've come to learn from this. It gets to the sun, and the sun is a bubble, like a cavitation bubble, literally a bubble of plasma. And when it gets energized, it turns into a arc rectifier, a plasma arc rectifier. It literally converts the alternating current of the spiral arm into the direct current of the solar winds. And so this activity is happening constantly. This energy is coming into the north and south poles of the sun, going through the layers and layers and layers inside the sun until it gets to the equator, where it sends out direct current. And that direct current is what we see as the solar winds. And that goes out to the planets. And so again, it even translates further than that, because the planets now turn out to be bubbles just like the sun, only they didn't get big enough to become the sun. So these littler bubbles now are stuck in that direct current flow, and that makes them start to spin in the magnetic field. They call it a homopolar motor, a one.
Okay, you got
And
it.
so all of a sudden, all the planets will start spinning because of this direct current energy they're now getting through the poles, through the aurora, and that drives them spinning because they're in the magnetic field of the sun. So they're in the huge magnetic field of the sun. They get hit with this electric current. They start to spin. And it's been amazing to me to see how these pieces just start adding up. Another one is comets. What is a comet? Okay. Well, it turns out in the 1800s, they knew. I found this book on astronomy from the 1800s, and they were talking about comets, and they said all comets come from someplace between Mars and Jupiter, and they seem to coincident with the alignment of Jupiter and Saturn, and that's where they come from. And so what it was telling us was there's something there, what we would now call the asteroid belt. And when the Jupiter and Saturn line up, they cause one of the with one of these asteroids, they fling it into the sun like flicking a card. Okay, and when it goes towards the sun, it picks up a big electric charge, goes around. Now it's in a big long elliptical orbit, and that big long elliptical orbit will allow it every time it comes to the sun to turn into a dipole. And because it's a dipole, the positive and negative voltages go to each side of the asteroid, now comet, and that starts to eat away the middle of it through electrolysis. And that's why when we look at comets today, we see this barbell shape. They were originally an asteroid, but they've been getting the middle of them eaten away. And when that happens, it creates iron plasma. It takes the iron oxide and the nickel oxide and converts it into iron plasma and oxygen plasma. And so you got iron plasma and oxygen plasma coming out of comets. Again, all of this is related to this cosmology. And when the
Now, when you say, wait a minute, when you say related to this cosmology, what you're doing here is transforming or translating the what you see as the cosmology that's and the physics that are in the hieroglyphics in the temple into modern terminology. Is that essentially what you're doing?
I start with the idea that the thing about the temple that's really interesting is it doesn't give you a lot of information on how to build it or how it works. It's more of a temple of like astrology. It wants to map the stars and know. But there's a handful of little pieces in the crypt about how it works. But what I did once I got it working was I started applying our knowledge to it. The physics that we can pull out of our physics books. So I started
All
studying
right.
physics.
We're
I
going
started.
to take a little break right now, folks. And when we get back, we're going to start to talk about just what he did pull out of it, because he's made a working model of this that's very extraordinary and quite different from there are a couple of other models, but this is a unique approach. And I think Bill's got something. We'll be right back. Have you ever read Communion? Or have you never read Communion? It's out in a new edition. Very powerful, a subtly new cover that reflects the fact that the visitors are now looking back at us because they truly are. You can get it from the unknowncountry.com store as a Kindle, as a beautiful, sumptuous paperback,
or as an unabridged audiobook read by me, it's the first time in the whole life of communion that it has been read in full in audio format. And believe you me, I felt that reading. I put my life, my memories into it. And I trust you can hear it in the voice. I sure felt it while I was reading. So get communion, listen to it, read it. Communion is of central importance to all of our lives. Where is the unknown country? Is it out there in the stars? Or is it also somewhere else? Is it in us, in you? Unknown country, join us today. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and join us. Join the questions. Join the search. Join the adventure. Unknowncountry.com. There's no place like it in the world.
We're talking to Bill Sosa, William Sosa. Bill has worked on the so-called Dendera light, and that's light bulb, and that's really not even the right way to think about it, because it's not a light bulb. It's not, it wasn't brought down into that dark place in order to illuminate it. It was brought there for other reasons having to do with the same thing that that all of Egyptian cosmology reflects, is reflective. The Nile, the Milky Way reflected in the Nile, and the entire world of Egypt was meant to be a reflection of the cosmos. And the temple at Dendera is no exception to this. And deep within the temple, underground, is a reflection of the solar form itself. And that is this so-called light bulb. Would that be a fair way of putting it or not?
Sure. And, one of the things I've noticed in Egypt is I've barely scratched the surface. I mean, you just mentioned how the Nile models the Milky Way, and even look where Dendera is. It would be located in the womb section of Nut if she was the Nile. It's really amazing how much they brought down their knowledge of the stars.
They put immense knowledge into this, and when we came. The Europeans came with strutting in with their, they were like barbarians, primitive people in fancy clothes. And the only thing they had that the Egyptians didn't have were basically better weapons. And this goes way back to the Roman period and the Ptolemaic period when the Greeks came. The Greeks overwhelmed Egypt simply because they had a better organized army and better weapons. And it's always been that way. This extraordinary, subtle, and very ancient civilization, which is, after all, the one longest-lived civilization in human history. It's now part of the dust of the past, but it lasted much, much longer than anything that has come since. So let's go down now into this place underground. And here are these bas-reliefs of this serpent in a what looks like a glass container. What is going on here, Bill?
Right. Again, the snake image in the tubes, and there are actually seven of these at Dendera. There are the three in the crypt, but there are three on the main floor, which most people don't realize. And there's actually one in the back in a smaller shrine to Isis. So And they all have the same pieces of it. There's the tube with the snake. There's the lotus flower. There's the box underneath the guy that's called a hay, HEA box. And there's some sort of electrical return. Maybe it's a knife holder. Maybe it's some water falling. Or maybe it's another tube. And but when I looked at this thing, I saw this snake, and I was like, "That is not a filament." I'm an electrical technician. So I'm able to see that the missing parts are there. I mean, they're not there. You would have a wire coming into the bulb and that sort of thing. So when I realized it was a plasma formation, that just opened up, the physics of it in ways I didn't expect.
You began to discover the physics of it while looking at the filament, and you've recreated that. I mean, you've got a working model of this thing.
Exactly. Our first thought, again, when we were working on it, was just to try and duplicate the image that was on the wall. We had no idea what it was going to be because we hadn't read the hieroglyphics yet, and we knew it was plasma. And my friend at the time worked a lot with Rife tubes, if you're familiar with Raymond Rife's work, and so he had some knowledge of working with plasma and things like that. And we were getting some really interesting formations, but we were never finding anything that matched what we saw in Dendera until we finally got a hold of some of the hieroglyphics that explained the gases that were in the tube. And it talked about the day and night tube. And I'm thinking day and night, alchemy, it's got to be mercury and sulfur. And my friend's like, "No, it's got to be hydrogen because we know the sun's hydrogen." So we got these two tubes made, one of hydrogen and one of mercury, and hooked them up to our power supply we've been using. And they did something strange. My friend was working in living in Utah at the time. I was living in North Carolina, so a lot of this work was done by him. And he would reply it to me. But anyway, so I asked him about the tubes, and he said, "Well, the hydrogen tube looks really good, but the mercury tube's going to disappoint you." And I'm like, "Why?" He says, "It just glows green," and I'm like, "Really?" So I went out there some weeks later, and we took a look at it, and sure enough, you could see the hydrogen tube has got this nice lightsaber beam coming out of it, but the mercury tube's got this like hazy fog, and I'm like, "This is weird." So we started upping the volume, the intensity of the electricity to it, the power to it, and it got brighter and brighter and brighter, and I started to notice that the mercury that was sitting there, started to push itself away from the thing holding up the tube. Where on the other side, the straight beam started attracting to the tube. And I'm like, "Well, this is a strange behavior." It turned out to be a very important piece of the puzzle, because once that was understood as two different gases having a positive or a negative charge. See, a lot of people think that ions are only positively charged because they expect an electron to get stripped away from a neutral atom. And I felt the same way. Any plasma book I'd ever read never brought up anything else but the idea of stripping away, using electricity or heat to strip away an electron from a neutral atom. But it turns out there are materials out there that if you put them in an environment where they're going to ionize, they grab one of the free ions, one of the free electrons in the and become a negative ion. And that negative ion repels the Earth, the negative potential of the Earth. And that creates this buoyancy. This idea that the thing now lifts up instead of dropping into the ground. And now what that allows you to do, what allowed the Egyptians to do with the bottle, is the bottle becomes a container of the plasma. The plasma will not give up its charge into the glass because it's repelling. It literally, you can bottle up plasma in an electric container, electric confinement.
You have described something here that requires all kinds of things that we do not think the Egyptians possessed, or any knowledge of. For example, we don't think that they could have built a glass tube that big, even close. We don't think they had any access to our understanding of electricity or gases or the physics of gases. But these things are all necessary in order to build what you've built. Now, the strangest part of all of this is if you look at other things in Egypt, such as the diorite bowls, and in fact, much of the construction in Egypt, the pyramids and the Osirian and many other things, you come to the conclusion that we actually have no idea what in the heck was going on there. And then you see all of this remarkable construction over thousands of years, but what you don't see is any sign of how it was done or any tools. There are no tools. We don't have a single tool to explain how they made those extraordinarily precise bowls and pots out of diorite, which is such a hard material. We don't know what was going on with these people. We have no idea. And this is where Egyptology has failed. It has tried to explain away what it doesn't understand and has no evidence to back. In the context of our always being the technologically superior civilization. Okay. So tell us what happened when you finally got a working model. What exactly is this model? It is, and we're seeing a picture of it right now, presumably.
I was going to show you this one.
Yeah.
But anyway, this was the first day. This is what it looked like after we got it working, and kind of see there. Anyway, those are
Yeah,
my
now
hands.
that's you can just barely see the glass there, folks. And what is inside it is the serpent that's in the image on the wall. It's the same thing. Of course it is. And to say that what you've done is you've actually created what they were seeing clearly, to my mind, quite clearly.
Exactly. I mean, we saw it immediately as well. And again, it started this process of what is this thing? Because I didn't really understand why it had happened, why there were two different kinds. So I had to get more into plasma research. Luckily, right at that moment, I ran into a book that described the electric universe. And that's when I first got into the electric universe idea. And the work of this guy, Winston Bostick, who had done some work with plasma and plasmoids. And almost
Yeah,
immediately,
I've read his book.
I'll tell you a funny story. As soon as we got the thing working, I had to use the, I had to go read. And I found a book. And as soon as I opened it up to page, I think it was 36. It's called The Cosmic War by Joseph Farrell. And I opened it up to page 36, and it spoke about the plasma focus device. It literally opened up, the book opened up to exactly what the thing is we just discovered in the basement of the house. And that was the beginning of my studies of the electric universe, plasma universe, and which eventually led me to the physics of what I'm finding inside these bulbs, how they work, and how they model the cosmos.
Okay, now the interesting thing is that they reflect the cosmos like so much of Egypt, as we
Oh,
were
yeah.
talking about earlier, reflects the cosmos. Where are we on time? Oh yeah, we're going to take another little break, and then we're going to be reflecting deeply on the cosmos as the Egyptians saw it. We'll be right back. My new book, Them, has now been out since March of 2023. I would like to thank everyone for the wonderful reception, those who have read it, who have posted thoughtful reviews on Amazon, those who have listened. It's an important book for me. And also, over the months, it has become a very strange book because if you listen to the Oversight Committee UAP hearings, you will hear David Grusch saying things almost sound like they were taken right out of the second part of Them. And I thought to myself, how did I do that? And the answer is, I have no idea. But the book is really very prophetic. And I think you should read it if you hadn't done so. And that's what this is all about. Read it, listen to it. It's really worth your time. Jacques Vallée certainly thought so. Mitch Horowitz thought so. Jeff Kripal thought so. Leslie Kane, Diana Pasulka, and all of the others who gave it blurbs thought so. And so do an awful lot of people who have reviewed it. So pick up a copy today. Go to Amazon and get a copy. Go to Audible and get the audiobook. Listen to them. Read them. It's a whole new vision of how we should think about the close encounter experience. And this is getting more and more important over time. More and more important. Them. I saw the future when I was writing that book. Didn't know I would, but I did. You can read it now and see for yourself. We're talking to William Sosa about his work on the Dendera light, as we call it. I'm not going to call it the Dendera light bulb anymore because it's not what it is. It is something else. It is intended to reflect the cosmos in some way. Can you get into a little bit about what you think that is? What is it doing?
Well, again, if the universe model that the Dendera light shows us is true, and I believe it is, then it's showing that the sun is not the source of energy. The source of energy actually comes from the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And even the center of the Milky Way galaxy isn't the source. There's these conduits now they're finding that are connecting all these threads, these webs of plasma that are connecting all the galaxies. So it turns out the universe is a whole lot more like a vine, like a flower. And that's exactly what they're showing you. They're showing you a flower producing a sun. Well, that's not just a metaphor. That's exactly what it is. We live in a biological universe. That's what the Egyptians are telling us. It's not a mechanical universe where dead mechanical things create living things. It's a living universe where living things shed off inanimate objects. So a lot of what we're seeing in the universe right now, the material is actually like the pieces, the dead leaves and things that have fallen off of a living energy that comes from, I think it comes from the Great Attractor. Because that, I'm always asking myself, where is it plugged in? You follow it from the sun to the Milky Way, center of the Milky Way, from the center of the Milky Way to where? And I think the Great Attractor is going to turn out to be where that energy is coming from. So again, now you've got this energy of life that's coming through the universe, through these conduits to the galaxies, to each and every star. And that eventually comes to the planet. And that's what causes planets to start to form life. So life isn't something that just comes to a planet. Life is what a planet starts immediately to do. It's like a seed, and it immediately starts getting energy from the Milky Way galaxy through the sun, and that causes it to start to grow. And that's why we have veins of gold and veins of copper. One of the big mistakes I've seen in cosmology is this idea that fusion creates all of the upper elements, all of the heavier elements. Like there was originally hydrogen in the universe, and fusion started turning it to helium and oxygen and iron and all these other. Turns out that's not true at all. In the diode sun model, okay, the hydrogen sun starts processes happening on all of the planets, and those planets start to take the material and they start to create the heavier elements. That's why we find heavier elements on all the planets and not on the sun. I mean, and the other thing is, one of the things that they're finding out from Webb right now is that they're finding galaxies at the very edge of the universe that have material in it that they say couldn't be there. They're showing spectral lights of oxygen, spectral lights of other materials, other elements. And they're like, the only way that could have happened is that if there was a previous solar system that exploded, the sun exploded. But that's not true at all. Turns out when a sun is formed, when you have the sun, the heliosphere forming, and it's kind of, it's all fluid dynamics. It's really interesting. It works just like a fountain. It works just like a fountain in a park. You've got flowing water that starts to spin. That spinning starts to create bubbles. The bubbles inside start to get bigger and bigger and bigger. One of them gets big enough to tap into the electrical charge from the spiral arm. He becomes the sun. And all of a sudden, all the others are now planets. And when that happens, all the material is the same, but the processes are different. What's going to go on inside the sun, the rectifying of the AC into DC produces helium and all the lower elements. But
Okay,
in the other,
let's get back to let's get back
yeah,
underground
I tend
because we're
to
diverting too
off.
far. Let me ask you this. We live in a society which has learned to exploit the energies and the riches of the world around us. They lived in a society that wanted to express a kind of relationship with them. And this is what you see in the hieroglyphics in not only at Dendera, but throughout the whole Egyptian pantheon, and all of the temples, starting at the Pyramid of Unas. Now, the Dendera light creates a plasma serpent, a blazing plasma serpent, which you showed us a few minutes ago. In the Pyramid of Unas, as you walk in on the west wall of the pyramid, is an extraordinary document that describes the interior of the human body. It describes the spine as a serpent of light, and that it is surrounded by seven other smaller serpents, which are rotating. These serpents later in, as this idea moved through the world, became the chakras. And this energetic force is this life itself, the experience of being alive, is pulling energy into this spine, which is then accelerating it. Now, my thought is, and I know you're not familiar with the material I'm talking about in the Pyramid of Unas, folks, because we've already talked about this, that this light is expressing the relationship between the body as an electromagnetic presence in the world, in the spine, and the universe itself. Does that have any credibility in your mind?
Well, again, getting back, I'm sorry about the glasses.
Oh, that's okay.
Getting back to again, getting back to the I'm sorry, I lost my train of
No,
thought.
getting back. Okay, let's go back down into the chamber, and tell us about the device itself. What must it have been made of? What was in it? What kind of gas?
Well, that's interesting as well, because there are more than one gas. Mercury has this, negative plasma. They call them anions, but there are other gases that do that as well: oxygen, sulfur, and a few others. And each one of these, what they're doing, again, you were talking about bringing life force down and through the spine, and you can see the people sitting under the thing,
Exactly.
getting a treatment. And one of the things I remember, the first day we got this thing working, first day, I immediately jumped underneath it because that's what I saw in the images. And you could feel the energy coming through the top of your head from the bulb. So you had the bulb on the table above your head, and you started feeling this energy, and you could feel it in your hands. And I was expressing that to my friend, and he was just laughing at me. He's like, "It's a fluorescent light bulb. You're pulling my leg." Finally, I dragged him underneath it, and he got the same effect. And for the next hour or so, we would sit there trading time underneath it. You could just feel this energy. Well, he got up to,
What was it like? Tell
well,
us about it.
I mean, it's just this feeling of you can feel, I guess it's, electrical. It has this kind of, like, you feel yourself in, if you've ever been in high voltage environments, you can feel the high voltage. It's there even long before it gets anywhere near to kill you. It turns out electrical forces, particularly electrostatic forces, not electromagnetic forces, because there's a big difference between the two. Electrostatic forces are like the things that the early electrical people were working with, Franklin and that crowd. Okay, they were working with glass balls and creating electric charges that made little pith balls move around, and they made motors that ran on electric charges. These electric charges have a property to them that's different from magnetism and electromagnetism. They are instantaneous. They don't have the speed of light issue. Okay. A lot of physics people today kind of fight back on that, but it's a fact. Electrostatic forces are instantaneous because electrostatic forces are connected to inertia, and inertia is universal. How do you know something's moving and then stops? Because it's connected to everything in the whole universe, and that's a whole nother subject. But so this idea that electrostatics, you know, has this instantaneous pull, and so when they built these devices, they were literally tapping into the sun. It's called a solar tap, and when you start to bring that energy down in to the earth, that's the same life force energy that keeps us alive. There's a saying, I don't know if I'll go into that, but I'll mention it anyway. There's a saying that the rule of threes, you can live without food for 3 weeks, you can live without water for 3 days, you can live without oxygen for 3 minutes. But there's a thing called chi. There's this energy that comes to the top of our head that if they take that away, you're dead, okay? And that's the energy that I think I'm going to digress a little bit. When astronauts go into space, I think they lose their connection with that energy. And that's why when they go into space, they get older faster. Okay, they age quicker. They come back and their bones are starting to, they think it's all mechanical. No, it's this energy that's no longer pulling their body into form. And so if they figure out a way in space how to create this plasma light technology, they might even get their astronauts to live longer. But that's a different, I mean, to not age so badly. But that's a digression. So the idea is that they're bringing this life force down and channeling more of it through. And there's one line that I found in the temple, one of the crypts, that totally blew me away. It said, the device draws down the energy from the sun that is the enemy of Sokar. It pushes back death. So they're telling you that this energy starts to rebuild your cellular construction. It literally anti-ages you. Now, I can't say that with my device because there's a I'll back up just a little bit. I only got my current device working in the last few months. I went many, many, many years without access to this device. Even though 2012 we figured it out, I lost access to that machine for many years. So I've only recently been able to get back to some of this active experimentation, active work. So, but anyway, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought again.
Oh, that's okay. You're talking really fast and saying a lot of things and stacked up. I've done the same thing. Okay, you built the thing just recently, and you're talking about chi energy, and I'm thinking to myself, you also discussed a little while ago the way it felt to sit under it, and you could feel an energy. And I think that energy relates, for example, to something that I feel very frequently when I'm touched by these strange little people I call the visitors. An energy comes out of their touch into my body that feels very electrical, and I have a feeling that this is all the same energy, that it's not electricity, that it's another energy that has to do with life itself.
Exactly.
The life force. And that's why these people sitting under the object were probably gaining energy from it and becoming more connected to the earth. Then they were like connectors between the earth and a higher level of energy outside of the earth. That's just a theory, but tell us a little bit about the figure that's standing in front of the light bulb with some kind of a face mask on it.
Yeah, that's the frog. He's known as Keck. And you can see he's got a tail. That's only one or two. There's only two tubes that have such a man. One of them's on the first floor, and one of them's the one in the crypt, the knife holder. And again, if you're looking at this as an electrical device, he's holding one of the electrodes that's ionizing the gas. And the whole thing about the tube that I've come to learn is that its shape is very important. At first, we were using just straight tubes that looked like hot dogs, and we weren't getting much success, even though we weren't using mercury at the time as well either. But one of the changes that we made was modeling the exact image. We see this bulb that looks like an eggplant or something. And once you did that, turns out that creates this imbalance in the plasma. And so it works just like, it's kind of like this thing here. I'll show you right now. I just figured this out today. I bought this device. I bought this device back in California, it's Exploratorium, many years ago. And I'm thinking about the tube, and I'm thinking, how the hell?
He showed a, what's it called?
It's called,
Because some of our listeners are listeners, not viewers.
sorry, a hand boiler.
Okay, all right. Okay, it's a hand boiler, and you heat the,
Right, you
yeah.
heat it on your hand, and it's got alcohol in it, so the heat immediately transfers it into a moving, and it starts to flow. And I'm
Right.
looking at the flow of the snake, because the snake is like a flowing water. It's like water flowing in a stream. And I'm like, wait a minute, I've started, again, I just figured this out yesterday. The flower side is warm. If you put your hand on it, it's warm. And the other side, where the snake holder is cooler. Well, it turns out it's just like one of these devices. And what happens is, when you start to heat up the you start to get this flow. Okay?
But he's showing, he's heating up the hand boiler, and we're watching the alcohol go from the lower part of the boiler into the bulb at the top.
And so you would imagine that the knife holder would be on this side, the lotus flower would be on this side, and that's exactly the physics of what's going on inside this thing. And so that's what I love about it. It's not really new physics in the sense we don't understand it. It's new physics in the sense we've never applied it to the cosmos, and the Egyptians did. I don't think they figured it out. I think they knew. I think they came.
Now, when you—that's a very important statement. Let's unpack that a little bit. You don't think they figured it out. You think they knew. I do. I understand that statement deeply. I think that they had a natural science embedded in them. In other words, they were part of nature, and as intelligent creatures, they were reflecting principles of nature that, for some reason, we lost touch with and have had to try to rediscover. That's what I think, because I don't see any other explanation for this.
Right. Well, a lot of this for me gets back to where consciousness comes from, and that's way outside of the Dendera light stuff. But where's the you that's looking out of your eyes right now? They've looked for you in your brain. They've looked here. They pulled up. We are avatars. We are like Martian rovers running around on Mars. If I was on Mars looking at a Martian a rover, I would think the antenna was the brain. All the information from all the sensors go to the antenna, and all the controls of all the rollers and arms comes from the antenna. So the antenna must be the brain. Well, no, there's actually a controller in Arizona running a couple of joysticks, and he's moving that rover around on Mars. I think the same exact thing is happening with us. We come in to this body through the top of our head and animate this, we bring consciousness into this environment. And I think if you know that, you can go back to that place where this intelligence is and get information. It's called the Akashic. And I really think a lot of this information is in the Akashic, so that's why they don't have it written down so much. They didn't need to. If you wanted to know something, you could tap into the Akashic and go get the information, kind of like the cosmic internet. And
You know, they probably weren't aware of the fact that this information was outside of them. It was simply part of what they were as
well,
people. And
I mean,
maybe
talk.
the priests were priests because they were more clued into this, more closer to it, for even for genetic reasons, conceivably.
Well,
We're going to take our last break right now, folks. We'll be right back.
The Fourth Mind, Whitley Strieber's explosive new book. The first time alien anatomy, alien genetics, the alien brain, and the alien mind have ever been detailed publicly. Learn how they think. Learn what they believe. Learn what we mean to them. Learn when they are coming and why. Then, in part two, learn why we don't have powers like telepathy, levitation, and healing that they do have. Find out about the catastrophe that took our powers from us. Find out how we can regain them. The Fourth Mind, totally new, incredibly important. Get your copy today on Amazon. Available as a Kindle, hardcover, softcover, and an audiobook read by Whitley Strieber.
So this is such exciting stuff because we're looking, when we look at ancient Egypt, at the not at the at a primitive beginning, but at an ending of a highly developed world. The earliest hieroglyphics we have, which appear, we have some very early ones, but the earliest complex writing is very sophisticated. The religious text in the Temple of Unas, in the Pyramid of Unas. And I think that Egypt came from somewhere else, but I want to get back to this, the bulb itself. Are there any signs of any glassmaking in ancient Egypt of the kind that would require be required to make these bulbs?
And to that I'd say no, because why does Dendera only have the big bulbs? They're not anywhere else. And there's only seven of them depicted in all of Dendera. I think they were inherited. I think they were inherited from a giant race. That's a whole nother story, but I don't think the Egyptians...
Inherited from a...
The giant race. The race of giants that are depicted in our history books. And I think that race brought some advanced technology with them when they came to Earth. I mean, sounds crazy, but you can see them...
I don't think it sounds crazy at all.
And so I think they were borrowing or inheriting the devices, the big ones. Now, they could make smaller ones, and there's a lot of indication that the Egyptians made blown glass 3,000, 4,000 years ago. So and there's pictures of them blowing glass in little furnaces and things like that. I show that in one of my earlier videos. The idea that, the Egyptians didn't have these technologies. Well, for example, there's another one is alchemy. Alchemy means the art of chem, the art of Egypt. Okay, and alchemy led to chemistry. They were doing all kinds of stuff with chemistry back then. They knew the embalming that they could do for their mummification. These guys were not novices. They were quite knowledgeable. And they were able to use these things called alembics, which is what I think the Dendera light is. I think it's just a big alembic. How did they get the gas in the bulb to come under pressure? Well, they used it like a canning jar. You heat the bulb with mercury in it. When it heats up, then you cork it. When it cools off, it becomes a mercury vapor tube. And you can see them doing this in the images from alchemists back in the 1100s and earlier. But the Egyptians did it as well. I believe, the art of chem, this stuff came from Egypt. And I think it came to Egypt from someplace else. And so Egypt's like this melting pot of cultures, spacefaring cultures, okay? And that's a whole nother story, the idea of the boats and the barks.
Well,
and that.
I think it's abundantly clear that we lost something enormous and that Egypt is the place to go to find what remains of it in the world now. At the end of the last ice age, sea levels rose on this planet 450 feet. We have never done any archaeology that deep in the ocean anywhere. So we actually don't know what the seacoasts were like even 15,000 years ago. And there's every evidence that these places, Egypt and Sumeria, were in the highlands. They were not centers of the world. The centers of the world were located on the seashores, on the coast, just as they are now. London, New York, one of the exceptions being Paris, Rome, all of these cities and the cities along the coast, Tokyo in the Far East, these cities, Mumbai, are their ports, Los Angeles. And if the oceans rose 450 feet in a matter of months, which happened now, all of those ports would be gone. And all of the treasures and everything would be gone. And I think that happened. I think something like that happened. Atlantis wasn't in a single place. It was the coastline of the world. So, now, you made brief reference.
If you ever want to hear it, I have a theory of where the water came from.
Okay.
But I don't know. It doesn't have much to do with the Dendera light. But sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's okay. We maybe we'll get to that in another show because I want to get back to the Dendera light.
Very good.
And we made brief reference to the people sitting under it. And I've seen another video where you show that the people sitting under it can affect the movement of the column of light inside. Can you explain what they are doing exactly?
Right. Well, this gets back to, the idea that it's electrostatic. Electrostatic means charges that just sit there. And if you've ever been in a house where it's very dry and you go to touch the doorknob, you get a shock. The reason you get a shock is because you can build up a charge walking on the carpet, and when you touch the doorknob, you ground that charge. That wouldn't happen in a damp environment. So one of the keys to getting this thing to work is to make sure the room is very dry, so that all of the electrostatic components work properly, kind of like not letting your iPhone fall into a pond. And electrostatics, as I said before, is instantaneous. You can feel your iPhones. Everybody has an iPhone these days, and they think nothing of touching the screen. But what is touching the screen really doing? It's a capacitive. It's feeling the electrical charge of your finger inside behind the glass, and the machine knows, hey, he touched it here. Okay, so that's what it's using electrostatics. And so the electrostatics is instantaneous. And as soon as the snake starts forming, it's very sensitive to its environment, to the electrostatics of its environment. So it starts picking up on your heartbeat, it picks up on your hands, it picks up on radio waves, it picks up on all of these things because they have an electrostatic effect. It's a very sensitive device. And so, that's one of the things that I learned about it, is this idea that we are connected into an electrostatic environment. Then that's the primary thing. It's not gravity, it's not fusion, it's not even electromagnetism. It's not magnetism or electromagnetism. There is electric charges in the universe, and that's what they're showing us with the Dendera light. If you postulate these electric charges in a universe, you create an electrostatic womb. Like I said, the bottle becomes the glass becomes a confinement of the plasma because of electrostatics holding it together. And I think the same thing happens in the universe, and that's where all forms come from.
Well, free Dreamlanders, I would like to thank you very much for being with us, as always, on Dreamland. And subscribers, stay with us because we're going to be looking at some videos of the lights in action and in operation, the lights that Bill has created. It's quite a remarkable experience. And if you're listening on the audio podcast, I would urge you to go to the YouTube channel. To have a look at this. I think that you'll find it very interesting. And of course, it's Dreamland Strieber, Dreamland Whitley Strieber, that'll get you to the YouTube channel on YouTube. Thank you again, Free Dreamlanders, for your time and your interest and your support of this program.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Ann Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.